The best part of Christmas for most people is not the rush of preparations or the hectic busyness or the long miles of travel. All those things are just necessary evils for us. The best part of Christmas is finally settling in for an intimate conversation and a connection with a loved one. Just basking in the joy of their presence and sharing what's going on in their lives and in ours. And that's what's going on in this text. There were a lot of preparations. There was a lot of busyness. There's a lot of travel that precedes this. But that hectic pace slows down for us on this fourth Sunday of Advent to a very intimate visit between two women who share a very strange and wondrous connection, because they have these unforeseen pregnancies that they are dealing with. And instead of being confused, once they gather together, they share love and joy. They sing, they laugh, they celebrate the way that their lives have unfolded with these unanticipated conceptions. There is just an air and an overflow of joy that proceeds from this story, and yet it's a very intimate story. It's a very tender story in many ways. It's called the Visitation and the Magnificat. The first half of our text is that visitation, and it's about Mary and the long trip she makes, about 80 miles from Nazareth, which in those days is about a 3 to 5 day journey. She makes this 80-mile trip after being told by Gabriel that she's going to bear Messiah, but also being told that Elizabeth has a child on the way. And so instead of just sitting around being pregnant, she decides she's going to go visit Elizabeth. Many people question why. Why do you make this long, risky travel in order to see Elizabeth? And some have surmised, well, maybe she just wants to confirm that the promise is true that the angel has given. Maybe she wants the wisdom of an elder. Maybe she wants to help with the pregnancy. It seems as if she stays until John is finally born. Or maybe she just wants companionship with the only person in the entire world that would understand her strange and unprecedented situation. So when Mary finally arrives after all those preparations and hectic busyness and long mile of travels, Elizabeth greets her, and there's a meeting of the minds between the two women, but there's also a meeting of the wombs, because all of a sudden John places this perfectly well-timed kick, and within Elizabeth is aroused in order to make a blessing, to declare joy that's flowing from within her. Now, I've never been pregnant. I don't know if kicks bring joy. I would imagine that kicks in some way give a sense that the baby's alive and healthy and things are proceeding well. But here there seems to be a sense in which John, who will spend his life pointing to Messiah, for the very first time points to Messiah. And he recognizes that Jesus is in the room even though he's in the womb. And John wants to point to Jesus and declare his joy. And Elizabeth, being overwhelmed with that joy, gives words of utter blessing. That first paragraph is just full of blessing. Three blessings Elizabeth gives. Blessed are you among women. You've been chosen to bear Messiah. Blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus. You are the mother of my Lord, Elizabeth says. Blessed are you, Mary, because you believe that God will fulfill God's promise to you. Elizabeth blesses her faith and declares, you are, though lowly, though humble, extremely blessed by God. You bear a special role in what God is doing. The joy is so overwhelming that Mary breaks out in song. That second half of our text is called the Magnificat. The Magnificat, really, it sounds like it was the inspiration for the song the lady sang this morning. It's been the inspiration from so many pieces of music. Monteverdi, Bach, Vivaldi, Mozart, Schubert have all set this Magnificat, which just simply means magnifies. My soul magnifies the Lord. That's how the song begins. They've set this to music. They've set this song, which is both personal and political, to music. It's personal, that first half. My soul magnifies the Lord. My spirit rejoices. God's looked with favor on my lowliness. All generations will call me blessed. Mary celebrates God's faithfulness to her. And then she speaks of what God is doing in the world with this great reversal. Verse 51, he's shown strength, scattered the proud, brought down the powerful, lifted up the lowly, filled the hungry, sent the rich away empty. This is what Mary declares the God of justice is coming to do in Jesus. It's called the gospel of the great reversal. All that seems right side up now will be made upside down, which is really to make it right side up as God intends. It is the proclamation of a new world order and a powerful challenge to existing structures of power. You notice there's a certain threat to those in power. God favors the poor, the lowly, the humble. If you're at the top, you don't want the world being spoken of as being turned upside down. You like being at the top. That's why it's interesting to study the history of this Magnificat. Martin Luther, who many of us look to as a spiritual forefather, when he was translating the Bible from Latin to German so that his fellow Germans could read the scriptures because only the priests could read Latin, when he was translating it into the common language, he left the Magnificat in Latin. He left it in Latin because he knew the German princes took a dim view of what it says. Thomas Cranmer, when he put together the Book of Common Prayer and he was putting all of these Latin missals into English again so the church could use them in liturgy, he also left the Magnificat in Latin because he knew the royals didn't care for its imagery. They understood, like Mary understands, like we ought to understand, that this message that she gives is not only a personal profession of piety, but it's a bold proclamation of God turning what's right side up, upside down. It is a very subversive song of saving faith, of reversing the way that things are in the world, of turning the established order on its head in favor of the poor and the marginalized. It's a vision that Jesus will carry on. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the hungry. The last shall be first. The greatest are the least. Mary's just proclaiming in advance the very same message that her son Jesus will give. And she proclaims it with great boldness. Look at verse 51. This is what I find most interesting in the song. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud. He has brought down the powerful. All that's singing in past tense, as if it's already accomplished. Do you notice that? She's singing as if it's already a done deal, but in her world and in our world, it's not a done deal. How can she sing with such boldness about something in the past tense to say it's as good as done already? And the reason she can speak of how God's great reversal has already begun is because God has chosen her. She herself is evidence of it. God's future can already be glimpsed in the fact that God hasn't chosen a priest or a king or royalty or people that are wealthy to bring about God's salvation. God is going to work through a lowly peasant girl to bring the greatest blessing of all. You do notice as Mary sings this protest song, the mighty are nowhere to be seen. In this culture, we just have two women. Two women with some very scandalous births that are marginalized, that usually aren't listened to. And yet these are the voices that proclaim God's working. And because they are the ones singing this, Mary can say as an already established fact, the reversal is already beginning. Now that's our text. It's a strange and wondrous meeting. If you think about all the elements of it, there's greeting, there's blessing, singing, sharing faith, proclaiming the gospel, joy over Jesus' presence in the womb. So much going on that I often associate with our gatherings together. That some commentators have said, this is the prototypical gathering of the Messianic people. This is the first gathering of people focusing on the fact that Christ is really in their midst. And if Christ is in their midst, then there is great cause for singing and blessing and praising and protesting and declaring God's faithfulness in this world. And if you look at it that way, you see all these elements and how they really picture what it means to be the gathering of Christ people. You have a community and connection. It's a small community. But where two or three are gathered, there I am in their midst. And it's quite a pair. A postmenopausal woman and a middle-aged schoolgirl. Both impossibly pregnant, both experiencing things that would isolate them from others, and yet they're helping one another understand their situation. They need each other in community. They need this connection that they might draw fresh courage from one another. These are women of diverse backgrounds and experiences. Elizabeth is well off. She has a good reputation. She's the wife of a priest. She's established. She's secure. She experienced shame in not having a child, but that shame has been removed, strangely enough, in her latter days as she's pregnant with child. She's established. Mary is scandalous. She has this very suspicious pregnancy. She doesn't look like she's good folk to be with. She doesn't look very faithful at all in her community. And yet together, they gather around the Christ. They share and support one another through their unique troubles. The thing I love about this first gathering is every person in this story has issues. Just like everyone in this room has issues, including the one speaking to you. And we come together not just for community, not from our diverse backgrounds, but we come to support through the shame, through the surprises, through the scandals that come into our life, through the unexpected things that occur to us. And we bring those issues together, and with kindred hearts we seek to impart wisdom and support and courage and blessing to one another. You see something very strange here, which goes against the grain of much in our world, and it's multi-generational. You have a very old woman, a matriarch, in fact, with a young teenager. And guess what? The matriarch isn't giving the teenager advice. The matriarch is simply blessing the teenager, which is what the new generation always needs. They don't always need our wise words, although that sometimes helps them. But what they need to know, like Elizabeth says to Mary, blessed are you. This is strange. This is new. At least Elizabeth has the fact that what she's experiencing is much like Sarah, Abraham's Sarah. She's having a child in her old age. There's precedent for that. That's happened before. This strange virgin birth, virgin conception, that's completely off the charts. That's unknown. That's as scandalous as you get. It's completely new. And yet Elizabeth, instead of being scandalized, says, blessed are you. She imparts blessing. You have a countercultural group that are maintaining a vision of God's justice for the world, justice for all. Mary speaking like a prophet, that God's on the side of the poor and the hungry and the vulnerable and the broken, just as the church seeks to be on the side of the poor and the vulnerable and the hungry and the broken. It seeks to advocate for and take action on their behalf, because that's what God's doing in this world in turning things right side up. You have a celebration of covenant faithfulness. As Mary looks at her situation, she considers her God and says, God is proving faithful, which is the thread that runs through the whole of the Bible. That when we are faithless, God remains faithful. And in God's faithfulness, God has incorporated Mary into the salvation story in a way that goes beyond any other person from that point on and subsequently. And finally, what they're doing here is this first gathering is what we do together. We respond to the Christ within. There is an overflowing presence of Christ when the community of the Messiah gathers. There is a sense that Christ is not only with us, Christ is in us. And Christ is being shaped and formed within each individual here in a unique and unprecedented fashion. And because of that, we laugh and sing and share our lives and celebrate the strange ways that God's Spirit is at work in our lives. We bless the other because we bless the Christ that is within, the Christ that's being formed, the Christ that is becoming part of the community. We bless and celebrate faith. All of these things are a lot like church, because this may be the prototypical first gathering of the messianic community. Now, as small and as intimate as this story is, once you put all those components together, you realize there's a strangeness to this story. There's a wildness to this story. These are women that are impoverished and marvelized, and yet, in the face of all the powers against them, they are laughing and they are singing and they're astonished. And they're protesting. There's a hint of danger in this story. They are speaking against the powers of the world. This is, if you will, ground zero. There's no more story before the birth of Christ. This is the ground zero of God's saving work. Not priests, not emperors, not the wealthy, not kings, but two marginalized women sharing their issues together, supporting one another, making connections, celebrating the faithfulness of their God, and speaking of all that God's going to do, because God is not only at work within them, but God is about to unleash God's Messiah into the world. One young, poor, unwed mother, one far beyond the ability to conceive, with the mighty and the rich and the wealthy and the powerful, nowhere to be seen in this story. That's the legacy we're left. It's why I really think one of the most beautiful things that we can do is consider how what we've done this morning has already entered into their legacy. We've done this. I've already shared with some people their issues. I've told them I'm supporting them. You've probably done the same. We've sung together. We've prayed together. We've blessed together. We've prayed prayers looking forward to God's faithful actions in this world. And one of the songs that was sung is as close to Mary's Magnificat as you can get. I was searching for an ending to this sermon. And as I was listening to the gals sing this morning at about 8:10, I realized that's my ending. Because look at these words. Sometimes you can only sing about what's true because it is so overwhelmingly joyful. My soul cries out with a joyful shout that the God of my heart is great. You can hear Mary saying that. My spirit sings of the wondrous things that you bring to the ones who wait. You fixed your sight on your servant's plight, and my weakness you did not spurn. So from east to west shall my name be blessed. Could the world be about to turn? My heart shall sing of the day you bring. Let the fires of your justice burn. That's that little bit of protest in Mary's song. Wipe away all tears, for the day draws near and the world is about to turn. Though I am small, my God, my all, you work great things in me, and your mercy will last from the depths of the past to the end of the age to be. Because the world in this story is about to turn. Would you pray with me?